Wars on Doctor Who. Star Wars on Doctor Who. Star Wars on Doctor Who.
His name is Rob.
His name is Rob.
He knows his Wookiees from his Daleks. Listen now.
Listen now.
Hear the Force challenge the TARDIS. Get your blue milk and jelly babies while we see which drives you crazy. Star Wars or Doctor Who.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Who Wars, the podcast for those among us who just can't decide between Star Wars and Doctor Who. I'm your host, Rob Irwin, and I want to start by thanking you for tuning in. We're getting tons of hits on our podcast feed, and we're punching well above our weight for such a brand new show, and that's due to people like you who are downloading the episodes and tuning into what we have to say from week to week. So again, thank you. And you know, if you're an iTunes user and enjoying the show, could I trouble you to leave us a review and a rating? And do note, I didn't ask for a 5-star rating and review like I hear some podcasts request. I always feel that's a little presumptuous. What if I don't think that was worth 5 stars, I sometimes think to myself when I hear podcasts ask for a 5-star review. No, the team and I would just be happy to hear what you think about us at all. Any ratings on iTunes, of course, help bump us up the rankings and let more people like you find our show more easily. So if you want to help us and help your fellow fans, please rate us. Moving on, how was your week? Doctor Who magazine reached my letterbox during this past week. That's issue 478, with Clara and the Doctor on the cover and the headline, Dark Side of the Moon, being a reference to the episode that comes after The Caretaker, namely Kill the Moon, which I think is a really great episode title, and of course we'll be looking at that in our next show. This issue of Dwim was also special to me personally because I have a letter in it, waxing lyrical about deep breath. I tossed it up on Twitter earlier in the week, a picture of this letter in the magazine, and if you dig through the show's Twitter images, you'll see it. In fact, I think I posted it at least 2 or 3 times over a couple of days, so there's a couple of copies of it in our images section. It's pretty hard to miss. Now, that's not the first letter I've had in Dwim by any means. I think it might be my 3rd or 4th. Gosh, maybe even my 5th, but it's one I'm particularly happy to have written to get my thoughts out there that, in my honest opinion, Deep Breath was as good as the debut stories the 9th, 10th, and 11th Doctors combined. Now, I know there's a lot of people out there who like the 11th Hour in particular, but I think Deep Breath really, really was better than all the other debut stories of the modern Doctors combined. It's not just, you know, the first rush of blood to my head on day one. I've thought about this over many, many weeks now since it first aired, and I still feel this way. I think that was a great, great opening story. I mean, like all opening stories, it was a bit scant on, you know, actual plot and so on, but that's what debut stories are. It's more about the Doctor and what he's going to be like and stuff. But I think what was tied around him, particularly with the Paternoster Gang and the way that Clara was acting and so on, was genuinely really quite interesting. Anyway, also on the Doctor Who side of things this week, I noticed Big Chief Studios in the UK is about to produce a new Matt Smith 1/6 scale figurine. This will be in the latter Matt Smith costume. I know the company's already done, I think it was a Series 6 Matt Smith before, in the tweed jacket and so on. And it's also done some David Tennant's and a William Hartnell. These 1/6 figures are really, really exquisite in detail and quite limited too, in terms of being a limited edition. I think the only one they've made that's ever really bombed was a 1/6 scale Amy Pond figure. You can still actually buy the signature edition and the limited edition of that at bargain basement prices, relatively speaking, a couple of years after its release. The Doctors, however, have tended to go very, very fast. I must confess, I don't actually own any of them myself because they're quite expensive, and with a fair whack on top for shipping as well, it's literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars for me down here in Australia. But I must say, I'm still always tempted to buy one, especially when I see what the sold-out ones are selling for on the aftermarket. Wow. That said, however, I do own some Big Chief products, though. I have some of the highly stylized, cartoony vinyl figures. Now, if you're thinking of Funko-style vinyl, or even Titans, who do some Doctor Who vinyl, you're off the mark. These are actually about 8 or 9 inches tall, and quite proportional to themselves, even if the proportions are on the cartoony side of things. They're not just the same body shape with different clothes painted on, like what I think most people think of these days when they think of, you know, quotation marks, vinyl figures. These are actually quite cool. And the editions I buy are limited to around the 500 mark, which are quite neat, and at £60 each. I know they're not cheap, but they're certainly a lot more affordable than the 1/6 scale figures that Big Chief do. Anyway, to get back to that Matt Smith figure, the new one, the advance priority pre-orders are happening in a couple of days on the 30th of September, 6 p.m. UK time. That is, assuming you're on that advanced priority pre-order list. If you're not, there'll be another general pre-order 24 hours later, if there's any left. The figure will also come with a Capaldi head, so you can display the figure as a post-regeneration doctor, and also Spanners, the friendly Cyberman head Matt Smith was running around with at the end of his time on the show. Pretty neat stuff. For more, visit bigchiefstudios.co.uk. My week in Star Wars, meanwhile, saw me struggling through Star Wars A New Dawn. Not, I hasten to add, because it's boring or anything, quite the contrary, actually. I've just been getting so smashed at work lately that I get home and after dinner and a hot shower, I can't do another thing at night, whether it's on the PC or reading a book or anything, nothing. So I slipped behind quite a bit in my Star Wars reading this week, despite promising a review in this episode. But behold, we will have a New Dawn review in this episode. Super sub Kate has rushed to my rescue with an ace review that you'll be hearing later on. Also in Star Wars, of course, we had the big Clone Wars Legacy reveal this week, but that will get covered by Kate and myself in the top stories of the week, so I won't say any more about that here. What I will say, however, is that I've got some listener feedback to share, and it is Star Wars related. Earlier in the week, Mike Tate, who posts as @KenobiDarth on Twitter, replied to me when I put out the question, when will we get an Episode 7 name, trailer? And I was indicating that Kate and I, or Kamadu, as she is on Twitter, had had our thoughts published in our latest episode, which was Episode 3, and you might remember us giving those predictions. Mike gave his predictions as trailer for new Star Wars, I think summer for teaser trailer, then actually near November 2015. And that's pretty much what I'd said in Episode 3, May, June for the teaser trailer and maybe Octoberish for the full trailer. So all good there. However, Mike then went on to say, a question all should be asking is, are we truly glad Disney is getting the Star Wars franchise? Why such the rush to get new content out? Why have Episode 7 when Lucas always said the story was about one character? And that's an interesting question there, Mike, so let me have a crack at it. I guess, to begin with, it's really two questions. In the first, why such a rush? It's because Episode 7 was already in development, even before Lucas sold out to Disney. And what I mean by that is, whereas we're used to seeing three-year cycles in the original trilogy and the prequels, when it comes to Episode 7, we're not seeing that because quite a bit had been done before anybody really knew about it, and that includes the fact that George Lucas himself sketched out the story. So to tie into your other point, why have an Episode 7 when Lucas always said it was about one character? I guess you need to ask Lucas, because the story in Episode 7, not the script, but just the story, comes from him. So my take is that although this is called Episode 7, it's not really continuing that Anakin Skywalker Darth Vader story. That story's done and dusted, just like George always said it was. They're just calling this Episode 7 as the marketing, I guess, is too strong to resist. And for fans and other people who just don't care that these three episodes won't be tied into Anakin's fall and rise again, you know, they think Episode 7 is just an awesome title for a film, and they really see the films as just one big space opera, not so much about one character. So to them, hearing that it's called Episode 7, yet not about Anakin Skywalker / Darth Vader, to them, they just don't care. And, you know, I fully expect after the 9 movies are in the can, there might be a bit of a break, and then we'll get Episodes 10, 11, and 12 at some stage in the future. Star Wars is just really, you know, unstoppable like that, I think, at this point in time. And that will take us even further away from the single character story in Episodes 1 to 6. I think over a longer period of time, the next 20, 25 years, people will start to see the Star Wars saga as just one big space opera, not one character's story. But you know, Mike wasn't finished there. He said, to tell you the truth, I was angry they cancelled Clone Wars. Course of Disney. Why cancel a show that's successful and everything was going great for Star Wars until that bloody mouse got it? Well, that bloody mouse, I guess, is the reason Star Wars will succeed and continue into the future. I think Disney is pretty much one of the only companies out there that could really do Star Wars justice going forward. I mean, Star Wars is an immense thing. George Lucas built up such a huge empire that anyone taking it over would need both deep pockets to buy it in the first place, to buy it from him, but then to fund new movies, which cost an absolute bomb to create, and to have all the merchandising, you know, sort of ability, and all the marketing ability, and, you know, all those things that sort of come together to create this massive empire that George had created, yes, but which other companies would have really struggled, A, to buy, and B, to take over properly and integrate into their own, you know, empires, so to speak. So I think Disney really was the best option for Star Wars. And when it comes to the Clone Wars in particular, I mean, I know I'm not the best person to judge here, because as I've said many times on the podcast, I gave up around series 2 or 3 because it was a bit kiddie and it just wasn't grabbing my attention. I am rectifying that at the end of the year. People will be glad to know around December I'm going to watch every episode in order, or possibly not in order, and you'll hear more about that in the upcoming news segment. But just in general, I can look at it objectively and say, well, there's 5 seasons and the missing episodes, or however people want to look at it. And that's a pretty good run. I mean, Mike, or anyone out there listening to this, how long did you want Clone Wars to run for? Did you want Clone Wars to run for longer than the actual Clone Wars existed in the Star Wars universe? Did you want 10 series of Clone Wars? Did you want it to run for 15 years? Did you want that sort of thing? I think there comes a time where everything has its day and everything is done. And while you might feel that Clone Wars got nipped in the bud, perhaps a little prematurely, perhaps that last season, season 6, might have been its logical conclusion anyway. You know, as I say, did you want 10 seasons? Did you want 15 seasons? I think that's unrealistic. It had to end at some stage, and it was closer to its end than it was to its beginning. So, although I'm not the biggest Clone Wars expert, I think I can objectively say that it was probably near the end anyway. And looking ahead to things like Rebels and New Horizons and things that will interest new fans, you know, because remember, once a series has been going for a little while, it's harder and harder for new people to jump on. This is why comic books reboot all the time as well, for example. You know, starting Rebels now, a whole new generation will start with season 1 of Rebels, and away we go. And of course, Rebels will also appeal to older viewers like myself, who might not have been as into the Clone Wars and all of that sort of good stuff. So, again, I don't think you can point the finger and say, oh, that bloody mouse did this. I think Clone Wars was at the end of its life, or almost at the end of its life, naturally. And what we're getting now, to all intents and purposes, even, you know, fans I respect very much who adore the Clone Wars, what they've seen of Rebels so far, and some of them have seen the debut movie and a couple of episodes besides, they, if not quite through gritted teeth, then, you know, pretty close to it, they're saying, yeah, this is actually better. And I think, you know, Disney looms behind this. So it's one thing to blame Disney for all the woes in the world and everything that might be perceived to be wrong with Star Wars, but I think they're actually doing a lot of good in the background too. And part of that is also having multiple projects on the go. I mean, Lucasfilm always used to sort of almost get tunnel vision on one thing at a time, maybe 2 things max. But here we've got the CGI TV show in production. We've got Episode 7 filming at the moment. Episode 8 is already in pre-production. They'll be filming in about 12 months' time. Everything is moving on apace, and at a pace that I don't think it ever would have moved on under Lucasfilm. So I'm really not trying to come across as a Disney apologist or a Disney fanboy, but I do think there's a lot of good in what Disney's doing as well. Anyway, now to finish up, Mike had one more comment, and I'll read it out here. It came in several tweets. I've kind of plugged them all together. And it says, "Now look at the books we read. We are told it's no longer relevant. I feel sorry for those writers who wrote them. And I know what I've said is subject to debate, but Star Wars, I believe, is ruined for those of us who grew up believing the Force was with us. We collected the merchandise. Well, I still do. But what about my Prince Shizor figure? He doesn't exist. I would be honestly interested in what others think of what I've addressed. I mean, 2 years each movie and spin-offs in between. And yeah, look, Mike, I hear you on all of this, but like I was saying in episode 3 of this very podcast, the novels that you talk of and the writers behind them and even your Prince Shisaw action figure, they were never, ever 100% canon to begin with. And I know that's hard for people who were never deep into fandom enough to sort of be up on this, but it's the truth. They were two or three rungs below G canon, which was George Lucas canon. And that's just the way it is, you know. For me, when the announcement came, and you can hear me talk about this over 10 or 15 minutes in episode 3, I never got that uptight about the whole canon thing and Legends thing because, well, those things never were fully canon to me anyway. The book still exists. Your Prince Shisaw still exists. And they exist at a level that they were pretty much at before because they were never regarded as full canon anyway. And now they're not regarded as canon at all, so they're not really that different. The good news is that going forward, you know, in an upcoming movie, if Disney goes, oh, I like the look of that ship or that character or whatever, they may pluck things out of the EU, which is now called Legends, and make them canon. And not just halfway canon, actually full canon, which they've never been before. So this probably isn't a realistic example, but say Prince Shisaw, for example, if for some reason Disney said, we want to tell a story about Prince Shisaw, they grab that character, they tell stories about him, Prince Shisaw will be full canon, as high a canon as you can be, because there is only one canon now. And that's something he never could have been before when he was, you know, two or three rungs below full canon in the past. So, you know, I hear what you're saying, but I also know there's a story behind it, and I also know that maybe what you believed originally wasn't quite right anyway. And I say that with great respect, and I say that, you know, as gently as I can, but it's the truth. And I think the multiple levels of canon were confusing in the past. I think it's half the reason why Disney has gotten rid of them now. That, and also just a general clearing of the decks to get everything up to date for episode 7 and beyond. Anyway, Mike, you've said, you know, what do others think? You're genuinely interested in what other people think. If there's people out there, if you could tweet in or email in or send me an MP3 with regard to what Mike's raised or what I've said in response to Mike, that would be really great. And let's keep this conversation continuing about this very interesting aspect of Star Wars. Now, strap yourselves in because it's time for my top stories of the week. And this time around, I've got a co-pilot. Okay, and into the news this week, and I'm quite excited because we're joined by Kate this week to go through the news with me. Hi, Kate.
Hello.
How's things?
It's going good here in Arizona.
Very good. How's your week been?
It's been pretty good. Busy but good.
That's always the way. So we've got a whole bunch of news here to go through. I thought it might be fun to start with the episode 7 rumors and news for Star Wars.
All right.
And, of course, if you're at home listening and you don't like to be spoiled, please turn off or fast forward or do something because we're going to talk about all sorts of fun stuff now. Probably the biggest news I saw this week were these chrome stormtroopers. There's two images that popped up. One was kind of a drawing, but the other purported to be a picture from the set of Star Wars. And we see the more stylized looking stormtrooper, but in chrome and wearing a blue hood. Did you see this, Kate?
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, and people are saying, oh, the hood might be just to hide the look on set. And I'm thinking, well, it actually looks pretty cool because they have these...
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, they have these big sort of, they're not shoulder pads, but these big things on their shoulders that come up and...
Yeah.
It looks like armor almost, and the hood makes it look slightly medieval, and they're in a forest, I think. So, yeah, a fan or not a fan of the chrome look?
I love the chrome. I think I like it better than those black and white ones that we saw earlier.
Yes, I've seen a lot of people against the chrome online, and I just don't get it because I like the new look Stormtrooper. It's a new streamlined kind of look, and chrome is a new direction to take it. I don't know what there is to not like.
I concur.
and also people have been saying, I must confess I don't follow Lego that closely, and people are saying, oh, a couple of years ago we had chrome stormtroopers in Lego. I don't think they're really a tie into this, but
just a coincidence.
Yeah, looks like we've had chrome stormtroopers in the past.
Yeah, they're just pretty neat to look at, and I would be happy if that shows up in episode 7.
Absolutely. And if other rumours are to be believed, it's not all the stormtroopers who are going to look like this. I think these might be kind of an elite force or maybe the personal guard of one of the main characters.
Interesting.
So we shall see. Okay, moving on. Oscar Isaac talked to Entertainment Weekly this week, and he said that the set is really loose and fiery and energized, and JJ's, you know, keeps a really interesting kind of set, and it's making them give really good performances. And I thought, oh, that's kind of cool, because I've never really followed a JJ Abrams film before, not even the big ones like Star Trek or anything. So I think a loose, relaxed set, you know, what do you make of that, Kate?
Yeah, I don't know. That was kind of an interesting way to phrase that, fiery and messy.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really an interesting thing for Oscar Isaac to say.
That's right. He also added, Carrie Fisher is hilarious and doing such cool work. Harrison is back. He went on hiatus, but he's 150% back. It's pretty amazing to see him bounce back. He looks incredible. So good to know the veterans are also firing on all cylinders.
Yeah, I get the feeling Carrie Fisher is a very hilarious person.
Yeah, she is. I've actually seen her stage show when she brought it to Sydney.
Oh, nice.
What was it called? Something Drinking. It was just stories of her life and, you know.
Oh, funny.
You know, being drunk and on drugs and doing all sorts of fun stuff. So, yeah, she is a very, very funny lady in person. That was a great stage show, too.
Cool.
Okay, moving on, we saw some interesting, perhaps production artwork. And in the artwork, if people haven't seen it, there are two people fighting with lightsabers. There's a green blade and a red blade. It almost looks like Luke and Vader fighting back in the original trilogy.
Right.
They're in a forest. The Millennium Falcon is hovering above them. And in the foreground, there's someone lining up a shot. I don't know who they're shooting at, whether it's Luke or the other guy, or we assume this is Luke.
I didn't even notice that the first time I looked at it.
Yeah. Now, who? now, how do we take that? Could that be a bounty hunter? But who's he shooting at? You know, the good guy or the bad guy? Or is it one of Luke's friends and he's going to sort of interfere in this fight? What part is the Millennium Falcon playing? Did it just arrive? Are people going to jump out of it? You know, I start asking myself so many questions. What about you?
Yeah, I was just struck by how cool that picture is. I mean, I would love to have that framed and on my wall. But yeah, there's, once you look at it closely, there's some really interesting stuff going on there.
Oh, yeah. And I think leaks like this could be deliberate sometimes because they do get our imaginations going.
Yes.
Okay. And finally, this isn't a rumor. This is actually quite true. Mark Hamill has turned 63. And I was kind of shocked by this because it made me think, hang on, how old was Alec Guinness when they made Star Wars? And he was the same age.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I mean, Luke Skywalker at 63, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I think, you know, back when Al Guinness was in that, didn't he seem a lot older than 63?
He did. He really, really did.
So, yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if Mark Hamill's role mirrors something similar to that of Al Guinness. So we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people assume that's what they're going for. He's now the older veteran, the Master Jedi and so on. But I can tie this back into Doctor Who.
Oh, good.
And the way I'll tie it back into Doctor Who is Peter Capaldi, the current Doctor, is the same age that William Hartnell, the first Doctor, was when he started playing the role. And in a very similar way to what you were just saying, Capaldi seems younger as well. It's almost like today's generation in their early 60s are a lot fitter and more sprightly, perhaps, than they were 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yes, it does seem that way.
And you know, just thinking from a sociological point of view, I think people maybe had harder lives back then, and by the time you got to 63, you were wrecked.
Yes, I think there may be something to that.
Yeah, it's just a really interesting thing. I'd thought of it originally with Capaldi, and now I'm thinking it with Mark Hamill. It's an interesting one.
Yeah, that's a good connection there.
Thank you. Anyway, moving on, Star Wars Rebels is getting rave reviews all over the place. The most recent place I saw it was in the New York Times. They'd gone along and interviewed a whole bunch of people and talked about the show. And Kate, are you looking forward to Rebels?
I am. I was a fan of the Clone Wars, and I'm really excited for Rebels.
Oh, that's good, because we'll get to some Clone Wars news in a minute. For me, I'm liking it because they're trying to go for this 70s vibe and using a lot of Ralph McQuarrie artwork and really trying to make it fit with the original films that I grew up on, you know, because I'm such an old man now. and for me, I'm getting really excited about it. And I guess everyone has different reasons for being excited about it. Some may have came to Star Wars through CGI TV shows. And so to them, this is just the next in a line of what they think will be a line of CGI TV shows. Someone else might have a different reason. So
I'm excited for the new characters. I think that that's one of the most exciting aspects of it. And you'll get to hear more about that in my review for A New Dawn.
Hey, nice cross promotion there.
You like that?
Yeah, that was great. Is there any character in particular you're thinking you might like as the series goes on?
Chopper is definitely my favorite so far.
Really? Okay. So
I love Chopper.
So neither of the Jedi characters, not Hera Syndulla flying the ghost, but Chopper.
Yes, definitely.
Very interesting.
How about you?
Well, I've already said a lot about Ezra Bridger, and initially I was really put off by the idea of having a young character in the show, because as I've told people on probably Facebook and Twitter and other places, even when I was a kid, if I saw a young kid in a show I was watching, I was like, oh, I don't need this young kid in the show. I'm a young kid. I want to see adults.
Right. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Doing adult things.
Yeah.
But I've warmed to him, and you know, the more footage I've seen, I'm kind of getting my head around the character, and I think he might have a very interesting arc over the next 4 or 5 years.
I've only really seen the 7-minute preview so far, and some of the other shorts too, but that was really good, and I'm really excited for it.
Yeah, I mean, they talk about how this series won't step on the toes of the original movies. And that instantly makes me think, well, are they going to kill everyone off at the end of it so that they don't clash?
Yeah, that'd be interesting to see how it ends. Definitely.
Yeah, it's going to be very, very interesting.
Yes.
Anyway, moving on, onto the Clone Wars now. In the last couple of days, we've seen new Clone Wars episodes. Well, they're not full episodes, they're sort of half-finished episodes from when the program was cancelled. And I don't know if you've had a chance to look at these yet, Kate?
No, I actually have not.
Well, I think you'll like them if you're a Clone Wars fan.
Oh, yeah. I'm excited to watch them. I just need to get some time to sit down and watch them.
Yeah, that's right. They haven't got the fully finished effects, but there's enough for you to sort of figure out what's going on. There's 4 in total. Ooh. One's called A Death on Utapau. One's called In Search of the Crystal. We've got Crystal Crisis, and we've got The Big Bang. The Big Bang only goes for 47 seconds, but the others go for 20-something minutes. So, and we've got the longer-haired Anakin, who looks more like the Episode 3 Anakin, and... all sorts of cool stuff. I think you'll like it if you're a Clone Wars
fan. So where are these supposed to fit in on the Clone Wars timeline? Do you know?
Well, I'm not the best person to ask that because, as I've said in the past, I stopped watching Clone Wars around Series 3 because it just wasn't grabbing me. And then, of course, after that, it apparently got much better and towards the end was just firing on all cylinders, and this is when I'd stopped watching. So this December, I'm going to go back and watch it from start to finish, even the early stuff that I wasn't
keen on. Are you going to do it the way it came out or chronologically?
Oh, you've thrown up an interesting idea now. I hadn't even thought about that. Do you think it would be better to watch chronologically?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, and that might throw some more interesting episodes earlier into the mix, perhaps?
Yeah.
Okay. Good advice. Well, I'll be doing that around December, come the Christmas holidays.
All right.
Okie dokie. Now, let's finish with some Doctor Who news. I thought this was quite fun. Peter Capaldi, who used to star in The Thick of It, of course, where he'd be swearing every 5 seconds...
I recently only learned about that, and I was very traumatized.
Oh, did you never watch The Thick of It?
I had never heard of that, and I wish I hadn't.
I thought it was a very funny show. Because I like shows that are set in government, and they're in a government sort of communications team, and he's just horrible to people, and it's funny.
Right.
And even now when the Doctor starts shouting at somebody, even if he's not swearing, I can hear Malcolm Tucker the character. And it's very, very funny. So, anyway, this piece in the Radio Times, Peter Capaldi claims he's not sworn for 2 years. And, in fact, back in the heyday of the thick of it, people would come up to him on the street and want him to swear at them. And so he'd say something really terrible to them on the street. And they'd think it was the funniest thing ever. But now he says he's not swearing anymore and he's enjoying being the doctor. And there's this really nice quote here. He said this on the Graham Norton TV show. He says, "I love being Doctor Who. I wake up in the morning and I'm Doctor Who. And when I go to the shops and buy a pint of milk, I'm Doctor Who. Everywhere I go, I am the doctor. And everyone smiles at me. They're pleased to see Doctor Who, who's far more exciting than I am."
Oh, funny.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the doctors have this feeling when they start playing the role. I think Matt Smith really got into it
as
well.
It's so iconic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think Matt Smith had grown up when the TV show wasn't even on, so he didn't quite get it, but when he became the Doctor and people would come up to him in the street, I think, especially little kids, and he could be this hero to them just meeting on the street, I think he started to really enjoy that.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, it is cool. So I thought that was a funny one to end on this week.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
All right, Kate. Now, we're going to hear from you later this episode, aren't we? You've already done your cross-promotion, but for those who missed it, what are you doing for us later on?
I will be doing a review of the new book that came out, Star Wars, A New Dawn, by John Jackson Miller.
All righty. And I must confess, I still haven't finished it, which is part of the reason Kate's doing the review this week instead of me. So.
Well, I hope you don't mind a few spoilers.
No, I don't mind spoilers. I'm the kind of guy who doesn't mind spoilers. After all, I do them every week in the show.
All righty.
All right. Thanks, Kate.
You're welcome.
Okay, then. Now, as you heard in my introduction to the show, after promising it for so long, I fell behind in my reading on Star Wars A New Dawn. So here's Super Sub Kate to the rescue with her take on the book. I'll be back afterwards with my own thoughts based on what Kate has to say and what I've read of the book so far. Kate?
Hey, everyone. Kate here again. I'm here this week to give you my review of Star Wars A New Dawn by John Jackson Miller. I'm sure most of you realize that this is the prequel to the new Star Wars series that's coming out shortly, and it's also the first book to be considered official canon, so it's very exciting for Star Wars fans. It's written by John Jackson Miller, who I think is a great author, and he's also very great with the fans. He's very active on Twitter, and he's given a lot of reviews, so I have a lot of respect for him. He also wrote Kenobi, which is actually the only other EU book I've read so far, and I really enjoyed that one. But I really think he's one of the best things to happen to Star Wars in a long time, and I hope that we hear a lot more from him. Now, before I get started with the review, I just wanted to mention that beautiful foreword written by Dave Filoni and read a few excerpts from it. He talks about how George Lucas taught him the ways of the Force, and he asks, "How do we move forward? We trust in the Force, and we trust in one another. The people behind Star Wars are the best talent, and they love Star Wars and want to make it great. They want to capture that feeling that inspired all of us. There are still countless worlds to visit and countless aliens to meet. The way forward looks clear." He thanks us all for our dedication and passion. And then he says, "The Force will be with us always." So thank you, Dave Filoni. We're really fortunate to have you in our Star Wars fandom. And I really have never been prouder or more excited to be a Star Wars fan. Okay, so getting on to the review. Before I start, I just want to mention that this is not a spoiler-free review. So if you're spoiler-sensitive, you probably want to skip to the next segment, which you can find in the show notes. Okay, so I listened to this audiobook when it first came out, the first week it was released, and then I just reread it this last week to do this review to get a better grasp on things in an ebook format, so I really like that. I highly recommend the audio version, which is read by Mark Thompson, but you absolutely do not want to miss the special excerpt that is read by Vanessa Marshall, the voice of Hera, which was produced by Jimmy Mack over at Rebel Force Radio. Check the show notes for a link because it is amazing. You won't regret it. Okay, so what I want to do is do a character analysis of the main characters, kind of go through a brief summary of the plot, and then give you my thoughts about this book. Okay, so, characters. So, of course, you know, we have Kanan Jarrus, who we find out was training as a Jedi. He was a Jedi youngling when Order 66 happened, which then his name was Caleb Doom. And he's the rough and tumble drifter, and he's just trying to live a normal life, as normal as he can, suppressing his Jedi ways. And he finds himself doing all these dangerous jobs and anything because he's able to withstand it because he's a Jedi. Now, I thought his name, both Kanan and Caleb, were rather interesting because I feel like maybe there's a Bible connection. You know, Kanan, although it's spelled different, you know, like in the Bible, the land of Kanan and the promised land. And then also Caleb, which literally means dog or bold, which really fits the character of Kanan. I thought that that was really interesting and probably not a coincidence. There's a lot of thought that goes into the naming process of these characters, I'm sure. Next, we have Harrison Dula. She's the very coy, mysterious Green Twi'lek, and she's seen a lot of evil that the Empire is capable of, and she wants to do something about it. Now, I thought her name was pretty interesting, too. Hera, she's the Greek goddess of marriage, women, and birth. So in this book and in what we've seen from Star Wars Rebels, she does seem like a very nurturing character. And then I was wondering also, perhaps it's symbolic about the birth of the rebellion? Maybe not. That might be pushing it a little bit. I'm not sure. But it's interesting nonetheless. Now, she's very young. She's about 18. But that makes me wonder, where did she get such a nice ship if she's so young? And also, what is motivating her? We see her very motivated in this book, but we don't really get a reason why. But I'm sure that that is going to be some of the things that we learn in the TV show Star Wars Rebels. Now, concerning Kanan and Hera, in this book, you can definitely see there's a connection between the two. But is there going to be a romance? Well, I'm not sure. It could go either way, and I guess we'll just have to wait and see with Rebels what direction that goes in. Okay, so more characters. Skelly. He's about 40 years old. He is a loudmouth demolition expert conspiracy theorist, and he was also a Clone Wars veteran. Although he's misguided, he does have a good heart. And ultimately, he ends up being one of the first freedom fighters to sacrifice himself for the greater good. Next, we have Zelluna, who is a Celestin, which, according to Wikipedia, is the same as Nia Nunn from Return of the Jedi. She's an older lady who has worked as a surveillance worker for many years, and she sees and hears everything. I would call her a reluctant hero. Next, we have Ogadiah. He's the sweet old guy who takes Kanan under his wing. He's also a proprietor for a bar called the Asteroid Belt. Hey, Disney, that would be a great tie-in for one of your Star Wars-themed lands. Who wouldn't love to go to a bar called the Asteroid Belt? And then, unfortunately, his death was one of the saddest parts in the book, but I felt like it was really necessary to help motivate Kanan to join the Rebels. Now, on to the big bad baddie. We have Count Vidian. He is the terrifying cyborg who's a superstar efficiency expert, and he's sent to increase mineral production on Gorse. Now, if you've ever had a corporate job, then you know exactly who this guy is. He's brutal, scary, and it's even more horrifying to read the second time. I thought that was a really clever twist to use his former identity as his own independent consultant because it just went to show how diabolical he really is. And then the last character I'm going to discuss is Rae Sloane. She's the 30-year-old interim captain of the starship called Ultimatum. Now, I thought all the scenes with her were very Starfleet. If you're a Trekkie, you know what I mean. She's very savvy and ambitious, and of course, she's an Imperial officer. I thought she was a very interesting character because it seemed like she had principles, and I sense that there is some good in her, and I'm pretty sure that we haven't seen the last of Rae Sloane. Now, just a little bit about the setting of this book, the majority of it. The planet Gorse is a tidally locked planet, which is only livable on the dark side. In my notes, I actually put slimy mudhole. So it's a wasteland, and it's full of rowdy miners. And this is in stark contrast with Gorse's shiny, large moon, Cinda. After the dark side of Gorse was depleted of minerals, they began mining thorolite on the moon, Cinda, because it's actually protected by the crystals of the moon. Okay, so the plot. The Empire is in full force 8 years after the events of Return of the Sith, and we truly see the dark times Obi-Wan spoke of in A New Hope. Needless and brutal deaths, backstabbing, constant scrutiny under an ever-watchful eye. Palpatine is in control, and expansion of his empire is always on his mind. Enter Count Vidian and Captain Sloan. They've been sent to ramp up production of Thorolite on Cinda for more Star Destroyers. Trying to prove a point, Skelly sets off an explosion on the moon to prove its brittle nature. He gets arrested and then eventually rescued by Hera. You see, Hera's on a mission to get as much intel as she can to eventually start the rebellion. She manages to get Kanan, who's instantly infatuated with her, Skelly, and Zelluna to join forces to try to save Cinda and Gors from certain destruction. So what did I think about this book? Well, while it did have a very slow and extended introduction, the pace picks up dramatically as you get about a third of the way through. I really enjoyed the memorable characters, the action-packed sequences, and overall cinematic quality of this book. It'll be really interesting to see how Kanan and Hera are further developed in Star Wars Rebels, as well as perhaps seeing what other characters might pop up in the future. I feel like John Jackson Miller really gets Star Wars, and I give this book 8.5 lightsabers out of 10. Do you have any other thoughts about this, Rob?
Other thoughts? Let's see. Although I've not finished the book, I've got to say it's really helping me better understand where some of the characters in Rebels are coming from, quite literally, even though a period of time will have passed between the book ending and Rebels starting. You just can't get this much backstory into a TV episode or even multiple TV episodes, so there's some really great insights here. That said, one slight disconnect I've heard some fans having, people who have seen some of Rebels and also read the book so far, is that because it's a proper adult novel, it does have a slightly different vibe to the Rebels TV episodes in some ways. They advise that people shouldn't read this novel and then dive into Rebels expecting exactly the same thing. If you want to read material that matches Rebels, you're probably better off reading some of the young adult Rebels books like Ezra's Gamble and Rise of the Rebels. Anyway, thanks to Kate for sharing her thoughts on A New Dawn. You certainly pulled me out of that mess. If you're sitting out there and you've read it, did you agree with what Kate had to say? Do you disagree? Do you think something entirely different about the book? Would you like to comment about something entirely different about the book? Whatever you want to do, contact us. Details on how to do so are all at the end of the show. And now it's time for Lex, or Lexiness on Twitter, whom you heard last episode talking about the awesome episode Listen. This episode, she's going to talk about Time Heist. Over to you, Lex.
Hi, I'm back. I want to start off by saying I agree with you, Rob, from last week, how you said that the episode, The Time Heist, is not revolutionary, nor is it evolutionary. It was just a jaunt, one of those joyride episodes, which are fun. It wasn't out of the box, like you said last week. So far, all of the episodes of this season have been very insightful, and this episode took a break from the heavy introspections of the Doctor. It was fast-paced and clever. And one of the things I love most about Doctor Who is that it introduces new concepts, or at least this was new for me, like a dimensional bomb. That was pretty cool. Wasn't expecting that. And it was brilliant. Probably we humans should get to working on one of those fast. Not for heists or anything, because no, I wouldn't want to do that. Yeah, so, hey, there were some great costumes in this episode. I didn't pick up on it until you mentioned Clara's pantsuit last week. Then I went through a bunch of the stills online of the episode, and I was sort of aghast at what I was noticing. I noticed an uncanny similarity with Star Wars. I mean, really, look at Sabra's outfit. The hood and the leather. She's a perfect mix of Barriss Offee, the Jedi Knight, and the shapeshifter from Attack of the Clones. And the metal-clad guards are all like C-3POs on steroids. If you look at the background people in the scene where the Teller is first introduced, you can see some interesting costumes, too. There's this girl with electric blue tights, red heels, and a psychedelic pink dress. And, you know, anybody with blue legs is fair game to compare to General Aayla Secura, right? And the Teller is straight out of the creature cantina scene from Star Wars. I was going to say that his orange restraintive suit is a lot like the pilot suits from A New Hope, but I think that's pushing it. Actually, I think the Teller's restrictive suit is just like NASA's shuttle pumpkin suits. Seriously, check it out. They've got the same black, wide, circular color thing. And, you know, they're orange. And there was the inexplicable background client of the bank that appeared to be in a banana suit. I don't know what to say about that one. So I might be a bit biased with this being a Star Wars podcast, but hey, I thought it was worth mentioning some of the similarities. Yippee for Doctor Who being like Star Wars. Also, I wanted to point out Miss Del Fox being the third of the show, at least the third, there might be another, of a powerful semi-evil woman that's brunette, has masterfully curled hairstyles, is heavy on the eyeliner, and prone to blowing kisses with carefully lined in and colored lips. You know, Madame Kavarian, the nether sphere gatekeeper of the Promised Land, and now Miss Delphox. There's a strange pattern emerging, as if Doctor Who is now making a statement to the world. Watch out for these ladies. Do not trust them. I shall take this advice and encourage you to do the same. So take care, everybody. Laters.
Thanks so much, Lex. Great thoughts as always. Watch out for those ladies. Indeed, Time Heist was such a fun romp. And hopefully Lex will be back next episode to talk about The Caretaker. Okay, and moving on to this weekend's episode of Doctor Who, The Caretaker. Now, this was written by Gareth Roberts, who's written, well, all sorts of stuff for Doctor Who in the past, both fiction and TV scripts. You might know him in terms of TV from things like The Shakespeare Code, which I thought was a very solid episode, The Unicorn and The Wasp, which doesn't get a lot of love, but which was an episode I particularly liked. He co-wrote Planet of the Dead with Russell T. Davies. He wrote The Lodger, which was hilariously funny back in 2010, followed that up with Closing Time in 2011, which lightning didn't strike twice, shall we say, but it was still a pleasing sort of episode. I guess I was disappointed by that one because it brought back Cybermen, but like many, many Cybermen stories, they just weren't used in an interesting way. And it was like, well, that could have really been any sort of monster or alien in that story. So, a little disappointing in Closing Time. And now we have The Caretaker, co-written with Stephen Moffat. I think Stephen Moffat has probably written a lot of the relationship stuff between Danny Pink and Clara. That's just my guess. And possibly the heaven scenes. And the rest is probably Gareth Roberts. I'm not too sure on that, but that would be my guess. Anyway, it begins... There's a fun opening, and I've jotted down notes as I watched it, the fun opening on an alien planet, and yeah, seeing Clara and the Doctor chained up and bickering and arguing, and then they get out of that escapade, and Clara meets up with Danny Pink, and she's got a tan because the sun's been belting down on this alien planet, and he makes reference to it. And then we go through a few more moments in Clara's, I want to say, rather silly life that she's leading at the moment, this life where, as I've said on several other podcasts, she is going off and having an adventure with the Doctor, then coming back to Earth and hanging out with Danny Pink and teaching at school, and then she goes off with the Doctor again, and then she comes back and hangs out with Danny Pink and does stuff at school, then she goes off with the Doctor again, and it's just like, oh my God, as I keep saying in all these episodes, Clara, you're a time traveller. Go and have 100 adventures with the Doctor and then go back to Danny Pink and teach at the school. You don't have to keep going back and forth. But I guess it's providing a plot device, and possibly the writers think, oh, this is really different and therefore it might be interesting to the audience. But, you know, listening to a lot of podcasts and talking to a lot of fans, this thing with Clara always going back to school and back to Danny, it's just annoying to people. People would rather she just starts off each episode in the TARDIS and the adventure starts there, instead of this soap opera type stuff. In fact, my wife even referenced the soap opera type elements that have crept into the Danny and Clara story. And they're certainly there. And indeed, on another podcast I was listening to recently, I can't remember which one, so pardon me if I don't reference it by name, because I just can't think of it at the moment. But one of the people on that podcast was saying that the soap opera elements are the reason why some of their friends are actually tuning in And I think the line was something like, oh, you never told us the show was like this. This is really good. And they're watching for the Danny and Clara story, and the Doctor and the time traveling and stuff is almost secondary to those people. So it's interesting how different people can watch the same episode and get totally different things out of it. I guess the one risk there is if that writers try and cater for all groups, eventually they'll satisfy no one. They won't satisfy the people who are in it for a hardcore, you know, soap opera kind of vibe. And conversely, they won't satisfy in any way, you know, your typical traditional Doctor Who fans either. So it'll be interesting to see where this actually goes in times ahead. In my notes here, I've jotted down a little line from Clara very early in the episode saying, I can do it. I've got it all under control. She's saying this to herself while she's looking in the mirror, and she's just been off on some other ridiculous adventure with the Doctor and then rushed back to be with Danny. This is what is playing out under the six episodes we've seen so far of this series. I mean, we're halfway through the series now. Clara thinks she has things under control. Clara thinks she's got it all worked out. Clara thinks she's, you know, pretty damn cool with the way she can, you know, boss the Doctor around and do this and that. But is she? I think she's heading towards a big fall. I've speculated that Clara might even get bumped off at the end of the season, and if not the end of the season, then possibly the Christmas episode. Because there does seem to be a tragedy lurking underneath all of this. Clara is trying to basically have her cake and eat it too. You know, she hasn't wanted to introduce the Doctor to Danny, although that obviously happened in this episode. And she's been trying to hide this double life and all of this, and it's all unraveling. And even though a lot happened in this episode character-wise, and the Doctor did meet Danny, and Danny now knows who the Doctor is, and that Clara time travels, and, you know, all that side of her life, I think there's an awful lot still to come out. Anyway, moving on, my next note I've jotted down, have you had a good wash? Or have you had a wash? And this is the Doctor to Clara. I always pull these out because every week I see people complaining about the way the Doctor talks to Clara, and I'm sure if I went digging on social media in particular, I'd find people saying, oh, did you see he said, have you had a wash to Clara? Oh, how rude, how rude, how rude. And no, it was just a really funny line. This Doctor does say things like this to Clara. It's obviously a thing. Don't get so hung up about it, people. Moving on, I've got to say this episode was good in the area of comedy, also good in the area of dialogue. And this is a hallmark of Gareth Roberts' stuff. I mean, we're talking about some of the earlier episodes like Shakespeare Code and Unicorn and the Wasp. They were good, solid episodes. I like them both. But when we got to The Lodger and Closing Time, where we had Matt Smith playing opposite James Corden, they were very, very funny episodes. And although it's not quite to the same level, this was more in that sort of comedy vein. And I think the way the actors played it was, you know, pretty much pitch perfect. Capaldi is a fantastic actor. Jenna Coleman, as I've said in several podcasts now, is just, you know, really at the top of her game as well and getting better material than she got last season. So she's doing much more with it. And that's been really, really interesting to see. Now, what have I said next? The alien doesn't look scary, but the disembodied hand is. And yes, I think for anyone watching this, the alien in this story, who we don't learn a real lot about, he or she is almost like just a plot device, and that's all it's meant to be. Doesn't look scary at all. You know, it's metallic, it's got a gun and all that. Yeah, great. But when we see the policeman get shot and a smoking, blackened, disembodied hand hit the ground, that's one of the most shocking images I can think of in Doctor Who for an awfully long time. It would probably even be in the top 10 or even the top 5 all-time Doctor Who horrific images. I was quite surprised by that. I really, really was. So, yeah, it's interesting when the alien doesn't look so scary, but what it can do to people is. Next, I've made the note, Ozzy loves the squatty, and this is something we hear the Courtney character say, and then later we see it written on a window in texter pen. And I guess a lot of people, particularly in the US, might not realise a squatty is a soldier. It's a very UK kind of term. Obviously, here in Australia, we get a lot of UK drama and such, so I've certainly heard it many, many times, but there would undoubtedly be people out there thinking, what's a squatty? And they may work out that because it's Courtney talking to Clara, and, you know, one of the names mentioned there is Ozzy, short for, obviously, Clara Oswald, the Squaddy is Danny, but they might not know why he's called a Squaddy. Well, that's why. So I just thought I'd mention that. Then the PE references. All the way through this episode, the Doctor's referring to Danny Pink as a PE teacher, and no matter how many times Danny Pink says, "No, I teach maths," the Doctor keeps coming back to PE and starts referring to him at times as PE as well. I don't know whether this was, you know, being weird for the sake of being weird. Sometimes we have these sort of jokes in Doctor Who where the Doctor will think something and no matter how many times someone says the opposite, the Doctor still keeps thinking it, which is kind of a bizarre thing given the Doctor is so, you know, hyper-intelligent, or whether there's some sort of other reference at hand. It really didn't sort of gel for me. I'm erring on the side at the moment that it was just being weird for the sake of being weird, which is never a good thing. You know, there should always be some sort of reason behind doing something like this. Otherwise, it just sort of sticks out like a sore thumb. But anyway, moving on. I've noted Clara and the Matt Smith lookalike. Obviously, some very funny scenes there. I'm sure we've seen this guy before, back even when Matt Smith was the Doctor. I'm sure we've seen him teaching at the school before and had noted, oh, that guy is a little like Matt Smith. That colleague of Clara's is like Matt Smith. Wonder if that'll go anywhere. Obviously, it's not going anywhere. But she's now with Danny Pink. But we do see her interacting with him. And when the Doctor sees it, I think some of the looks he gives Clara, not even the things he says, but the looks are like, oh, that's your boyfriend. Looks like I used to look like. I thought that was quite funny stuff. Oh, yeah, the Doctor whistling from Another Brick in the Wall, you know, that we don't need no education. I don't know if many people would have picked that up. It's fairly subtle, but obviously in a school environment, I thought that was quite a funny thing. I don't know whether the script actually specified he should whistle that or whether the Doctor should just whistle at Clara and Capaldi decided to perhaps whistle that. But I picked up on that very, very funny. Moving along, I've jotted down, what were the others like? Did you let them get away with it? This is Clara talking to the Doctor about his past companions, and as soon as she said this, I sort of sat up in my chair and thought, hang on, you've split yourself all through time and saved all the Doctors and undoubtedly would have seen him with companions in the past. Why do you seem to know so little about, you know, how he's interacted with his companions before? I found that a very strange sort of line. Unless, again, like the references to Danny being a PE teacher, this is actually leading somewhere. Because I do remember in some past episodes, Clara has said things, and I've thought to myself, well, hang on, you know an awful lot about the Doctor. You should know the answer to that. Why are you asking that? Is there a reason behind that? I'm not entirely sure. So that line sort of stood out to me. And then we get to a very interesting character-oriented piece in the story. I mean, a lot of the story is character-oriented, but this bit in particular, it's when the Doctor dispatches the alien into the vortex for the first time, and Danny's sort of surprised by this, and, you know, Clara is still trying to cover it up and saying, you know, it's a play, and that was a lighting effect, and it was one of the students in a costume. And Danny's just like, what, do you think I'm stupid? And this is Clara, again, trying to control everything, trying to have a cake and eat it too, flat out lying to people. You know, all of this is going to come back, I'm sure, and, you know, bite her in the bum, as we would say in Australia. I think it can't be anything but that, because it's just happening in so many episodes, the lying and the deception. And I don't think Clara is a bad person. I don't think she's doing this for, you know, material gain or anything like what would drive people to do this kind of thing normally. I think she's just got herself down a particular rabbit hole and, you know, can't get out of it. Obviously, this episode kind of extracts her a little bit from it, but there's still an awful lot that's gone on. I think she's sown a lot of doubt already in Danny Pink's mind that she might not be always quite reliable with the truth. But of course, we did get some funny moments in that scene as well, because it's where the Doctor finally realizes that Clara is in love with Danny Pink and not the Matt Smith lookalike who he'd been assuming. And Danny Pink's thinking, oh my God, Clara is from space and the Doctor is her father. It's her space dad, as he says. I thought that was hilarious. Clara, then, I mean, this scene goes from, you know, from drama to humor and back again. We have Clara blurting out that, you know, she loves Danny. And the Doctor says, Why would you say that? Is this part of the surprise play? And it's such a vulnerable and childlike line from the Doctor in the middle of all this other humour and everything else that's going on, it really stood out to me the way Capaldi delivers that line. I thought was really, really nice. And I guess it's an example of the Doctor, you know, who's meant to be hyper-intelligent, having a sort of a dumb moment, but it's just so beautiful. Why would you say that? Is this part of the surprise play? Coming on from the previous episode, the bank heist, where at the end, I made note of this in the last podcast, the Doctor saying, you know, we robbed a bank, beat that for a date. It's starting to be that the Doctor, who said, I'm not your boyfriend, in the first episode this season, does seem to be a little jealous, does seem to actually have some interest in Clara, even though we have all these lines about her and her painted face and her wired face and, oh, you've had a wash and all this. There's something deeper going on between the Doctor and Clara here. I'm not sure it's actually going to blossom into a romance or anything like that. Don't get me wrong there. But I think what we initially saw of the Doctor and his anger and his attitude and everything isn't quite the full Monty, so to speak. I think there's a lot more going on under the surface. And his relationship with Clara is, I think, a lot more complicated than it might have seemed at first. I think we'll see that play out over the next 6 episodes. And by Christmas, when she's leaving, by all accounts, I think we might have a bit of a tragedy on our hands. But that's just speculation at the moment. That scene after we had the comedy of the space dad and we had the Doctor being so childlike with that line I liked did end, though, with Danny leaving the room and then the Doctor saying to Clara, you've explained me to him, but you haven't explained him to me. And it ended on a sort of a darker note there. So again, that scene just went up and down and up and down. Interesting. A little later in the episode, Danny confronts Clara on, you know, all the lying she does, now that he knows a little more about her life. And yet Clara continues the deception by, you know, giving Danny the watch that will make him invisible, and then he can spy on a conversation of hers with the Doctor. The Doctor, of course, is wise to this, and Danny, you know, decloaks himself or makes himself uninvisible or whatever the term might be. And then we got one of the most interesting scenes in the whole show. Danny, if I can put it very crudely, behaves like a total dick to the Doctor. I found this all a bit unnecessary, actually, but I think it's going to be quite telling in terms of their relationship going forward. And that's where the Doctor referred to himself as a Time Lord, and just out of nowhere, Danny just snaps and, you know, starts making all these assumptions about the Doctor. Oh, because you're a Time Lord, you obviously talk this way, you act this way. And Danny, who was never an officer, it seems, in the army, was perhaps a sergeant. The Doctor's referring to him multiple times as a sergeant in this episode. I don't know whether that's because he knows he was a sergeant or not. The Doctor's saying, no, you don't salute me. You don't call me sir. And yet Danny's saying, oh, yeah, yes, sir, and, you know, saluting him and just behaving like a bit of a moron, actually, and setting up a real sort of schism between these two. And obviously it's for dramatic effect, but in these scenes, Danny, who can be so reasonable and who's the poor guy being lied to most of the time by Clara and who we feel sympathy for quite a lot of the time here, I was just thinking, dude, you're a dick. I don't know how you felt out there about that. Write in and let me know. And, you know, in these scenes with Danny and the Doctor, I'm reminded of an article I read. I am absolutely sure it was an interview with Stephen Moffat. And I'm sure he was talking about the Doctor being a Time Lord and thinking he's the smartest man in the room and obviously coming from a certain class. And just the way the Danny Pink character was reacting here with regard to the Doctor in those same ways, I'm thinking might have been from Stephen Moffat's pen. I think that's the way Stephen Moffat sees the Doctor, and he was sort of feeding those lines into Danny Pink. After the alien threat, though, is dispatched for the second time in the episode, the relationship between Danny and the Doctor is thawing a little. Danny even makes a point, you know, he can hate me, he can like me, I don't care. What's most important is that he knows that I'm good enough for you. He's saying this to Clara. And the Doctor, you know, goes along with this. And here we see Capaldi softening, I think, and the relationship with him and Danny, you know, that's going to be a fun relationship going forward, because I don't think all the bridges are mended by any means. We've obviously got them to a point where maybe they could adventure together, maybe they're going to do more stuff together. I think obviously they are, but I think there's always potential still at the moment for Danny to just snap at the Doctor and for the Doctor to snap and to shout at him too. So there's some interesting stuff going on there. Oh, and just before that alien was dispatched, I've got to highlight the somersault. Danny Pink running into the room and then taking this huge somersault over the alien to Clara. Now, it was awfully unrealistic to me. My wife kind of looked at me like, are you kidding? You know, the guy's in street clothes doing something that, you know, a gymnast would find challenging. And that's a gymnast with a springboard or something to give them, you know, some bounce. And Danny Pink just runs in and does this highly unrealistic, bizarre somersault over the alien. Was it just a flight of fancy? Was it just something in the script that we're meant to go, oh yeah, and just leave it at that? Or is Danny something more? Did that give us a hint that Danny's something more? Is he, well, we know he's a soldier. Is he a super soldier? You know, if I can get all X-Files for a moment. Does anyone remember the X-Files super soldiers? You know, just seeing Danny do that, I can't honestly believe it was just there for us to gloss over. I'm thinking it's got to be a hint towards something in Danny. That's not regular army training, you know. I know army guys love to do tumbles and they wrestle with each other, but do they learn, like, really advanced gymnastics like that? Can they leap off the ground and do massive somersaults like they're a ninja in a, you know, kung fu movie or something? No. So that was interesting. Then, of course, I've neglected to mention Courtney Woods, the schoolgirl Courtney Woods popping up and, you know, visiting the Doctor twice in the episode, asking about the TARDIS, and the second time actually being shown inside it and being told what it is. And then we see her getting taken up into space, which is something she asked, can I go into space? And the Doctor has obliged her with that request, and she vomits, and I thought that was quite funny. And it got me thinking, you know, if Courtney Woods does a bit of travelling with the Doctor, and so does Danny, we'll have an older Doctor, two teachers from Coal Hill School, and a Coal Hill student. Now, does that remind anyone of a very, very famous TARDIS crew? Perhaps, possibly the first TARDIS crew? It seems too obvious to me, but at the same time, it does look like Courtney will adventure with them. It does look like Danny gets involved too. It could be that the Capaldi TARDIS for at least some adventures will mirror the William Hartnell TARDIS of 1963-64. Very, very interesting stuff. Rounding out the episode then, we got to see Heaven or Paradise or the Nethersphere as it's being referred to, and the policeman who was killed earlier in the episode appearing there and chatting with a guy at a desk. The guy at the desk actually is Chris Addison, or the character is played by Chris Addison, who was one of Peter Capaldi's co-actors in The Thick of It. So I thought that was an interesting sort of tie in there. He doesn't look like his character in The Thick of It. His hair looked quite different in this episode. But yeah, that was a Thick of It actor there. And we saw Missy. I think this must have been shot against blue screen or something, probably at another time, because it looked slightly fake and she didn't really interact with the policeman or the Chris Addison character, and just sort of looked at them and then walked away. So I think that might have been filmed at some other time. But it was good to see Missy back, because we hadn't been seeing the Missy scenes for the last few episodes, and I was wondering whether that had all gone silent for a reason or not, but no, it's popped up again, and I think we'll obviously learn a lot more about that as we run down to the final two-parter at the end of this series. I'm really intrigued as to, you know, what the Nethersphere or Heaven or Paradise really is, at least in terms of Doctor Who lore, who Missy really is. I mean, there are people out there who think Missy is somehow Clara. There are people out there who think Missy is the master, but in a female body, so she's the mistress, hence Missy. There are people out there who think Missy is the Doctor. There are people out there who think all sorts of things. It's like following Star Wars Episode 7 rumors. You know, people get a whiff of something or see a picture or something or learn a little bit of information, and then they start to infer a lot more. And that's what we've got with Missy at the moment. So, you know, all bets are off. I'm trying not to spoil myself too much on Doctor Who. It's weird. I try to spoil myself quite a bit on Star Wars, but on Doctor Who, I hold off quite a bit. So all I hear is what people are speculating at the moment. And if you have any other ideas on who Missy might be and where this is all heading, please write in and let me know. Okay, so wrapping up, I quite enjoyed this episode. Like last week's episode, it was a good, solid episode of Doctor Who to me. I know people out there aren't liking it. I've seen the comments on social media. Even my own wife was not into that episode. She thought the alien was just, you know, a plot device. She thought the character development was, you know, interesting but not vital. She wants to see, you know, a different kind of Doctor Who. And so there are people out there, people who live very close to me, obviously, who think differently to me. I know my view is not the only view out there, but I quite enjoyed it. I like where this is all going. You know, even if I don't like the things Clara does at times, even if I don't like the way Danny Pink was a dick to the Doctor in this episode, they're small potatoes compared to the overall picture, which I think is slowly unraveling. And if it does pay off in the way I hope it pays off, with Clara falling somehow because of all these actions she's taken and all the things that she's done through these stories. I mean, if you want a really good rundown of Clara in the series so far, listen to one of the recent Diddly Dumb podcasts. And towards the end of an episode, Al, one of the three guys who presents that podcast, talks about things that Clara's done, like taking the little toy soldier without a gun and giving that to the young Danny Pink. And then we saw the Orson Pink character in the future with that, but we've also seen the Doctor with that as well. So there's, you know, a paradox going on there with that little toy soldier. Clara is making things happen and is doing things that are causing, I think, greater ripples in time and space than she might realize. And I do hope this pays off in some big way. I really do. I hope there's a genuine payoff in this and not something which is a letdown at the end of it. Anyway, as I've said a few times in this review, if you've got any thoughts on this, or even just Doctor Who in general, please write in, email, Twitter, Facebook, MP3 files, whatever you like. All the details are at the end of the show. I thought it might be fun before we sign off for this episode to pull out the new edition of Doctor Who magazine and look at the preview for next week's episode, Kill the Moon, for people who don't get the magazine, and especially for people who take the time to listen to these podcasts in the week they come out, i.e. the week before this episode is going to air. So let me read you an excerpt from this preview. Back in the spring of this year, the first scraps of news about the recording of the 12th Doctor's first series were starting to make it into the press. Every press release was pounced upon by hungry fans as if it was the last sandwich at the picnic. And then, in May, executive producer Stephen Moffat made an announcement about writer Peter Harness's upcoming episode. For the first time since 1984, he said, the Doctor Who production team is heading to Lanzarote. The Doctor is returning to the scene of an old adventure, but there have been sinister changes since his last visit. In 1984's Planet of Fire, some scenes were filmed in Lanzarote, which stood in for Sarn, the site of the Fifth Doctor's battle with the Master. The internet was suitably inflamed. What might this mean? Why Sarn? Could it be... is the Master back? Hold your horses. What's rule one of being a Doctor Who fan? Stephen Moffat lies, or at the very least, he dissembles. When we receive our copy of the script for this episode, there is, in big letters on the first page, Return to Sarn by Peter Harness, but it doesn't take many more pages to realise that the title is, how do we put this, a big fat fib. That was Stephen's idea, Peter says. We called it Return to Sarn for a bit, but nobody picked that up. Nobody thought we were actually writing a prequel to Planet of Fire. He sounds slightly disappointed. I'm just going to give everything a ridiculous title from now on. We point out that the real title for this episode, Kill the Moon, is pretty ridiculous anyway. Somebody pointed out that it's kind of a quote from the balcony scene in Romeo and Juliet, he says. Arise, fair sun, and kill the envious moon. So, I can always pretend I was being very cerebral and poetic, but I wasn't really. It was just something in the vein of Let's Kill Hitler. It might have been called Let's Kill the Moon at one point. If you hadn't figured it out yet, the episode is set on Earth's moon, the location for Doctor Who adventures, the moon base, the seeds of death, frontier in space, and Smith and Jones. And have there been sinister changes since the Doctor last visited? Oh, have there ever. Now, I'll skip forward a bit in the article here and get to the conclusion. As you'll see from the episode's opening moments, this episode's focus on Clara is laser sharp. I really like what Jenna Coleman's done with Clara's character in this series, Peter says, and I'd love to see it develop. I'd love to see how their relationship plays out. There's plenty of playing out to be done in Kill the Moon, as the Doctor opens Courtney's eyes to the universe and puts Clara on the spot. Though, of course, nothing goes quite as he expects. By the end of the episode, and I know we say this kind of thing a lot, but believe us, things will never be the same again. It's such a high concept idea, Peter says, and the difficulty with those ideas is that they sound great on paper, but what is the actual story? Kill the Moon has a very gettable idea, but then if you want to actually turn it into an engaging story, you've got to build a decent human story around it. When I was initially developing it, he continues, it had elements of what Courtney and Clara go through with the Doctor, but the story was still kind of looking for a beefy, emotional through line. So it was just very good that those other characters were there when I came back to it. I picked up Courtney from Gareth Roberts' episode before me. I wanted the Doctor to take someone else along, and preferably for it to be one of Clara's pupils. When I was originally developing it a year earlier, when Clara was a nanny, it would have been one of her charges, but after her journey in The Caretaker, I thought I could take her somewhere else. By the end of the episode, once you've started breathing again, after a final scene that Stephen Moffat calls his favourite this year, you may wonder where the Doctor goes from here. I still don't know how people will take it, Peter admits. I'm in this kind of limbo now, waiting for people to see the episode, and I've no idea, really I do not know, how it's going to go down. I've never seen the Doctor do something like this before. Now, if that doesn't whet your appetite for Kill the Moon, I don't know what will. If you'd like to read the full episode preview, it's in DWIM number 478, written by David Bryher, and I think it's well worth your time if you can get your hands on it between now and next weekend.
Hey everyone, it's me again. I hope you've enjoyed hearing from the correspondents that have been added to the Who Wars show. One of the great things about being in a fandom like Star Wars is hearing from people with various thoughts or opinions. We all have this common bond, but new or different perspectives can really help to broaden our appreciation and make us love our fandom even more. Do you have something to say that you'd like other fans to hear, especially along the Star Wars side of things? Rob is still looking for people to join the Who Wars team. You don't need any podcasting experience, just a voice and a microphone. So if this is something that sounds interesting to you, drop Rob a line. You can reach him at hello@whowars.net.
So here we are at the end of the fourth Who Wars. I hope you enjoyed that episode. I really loved having more contributions from our team in this episode, and long may they continue. If you're out there and you want to contribute, like Kate was saying earlier, please get involved. This is a podcast that's meant to be for everyone. This is a podcast that I don't want it to be too cliquish or insular. You know, some podcasts can get like that. I was listening to one once and following some of the people from it on Twitter, and one of them one day said, you know, I don't think I could listen to a podcast unless I was on it or one of my friends was on it. And I thought, wow, you know, I don't think I could believe someone actually making that comment. But that's podcasting for you. I don't want this show to ever be like that. I want this show to always be something that people can be part of the team, and if not part of the team, then at least, you know, toss in an MP3 from time to time, ask us stuff on Twitter that we'll mention here on the show, and always have that conduit to myself or any of the other contributors to be involved. I think that's the whole reason to do grassroots, you know, fandom stuff like this. I don't get the whole, you know, clicky, insular podcasts that are out there. In fact, I just stopped listening to them personally. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox there and say, before I go, some late mail, something that didn't make it into my introduction to the show, or indeed into the news pieces for the week, is that Linda Bellingham, who played the Inquisitor in the 1986 Doctor Who season, which gets called Trial of a Time Lord, that's the umbrella title across all the episodes of that season, she was diagnosed, unfortunately, with colon cancer in June last year. She's only 66 years of age, and she's told the Daily Mail that she only has weeks to live, and she has picked the date when she'll die. She's picked for just after Christmas. Now, she's going to do this by stopping chemotherapy in November sometime, and then I guess they know how long it takes after stopping chemo for your body to run down. So that is deeply, deeply sad. Only 66 years of age and, you know, a great Doctor Who actress, as well as appearing in many other TV shows and even adverts in the UK going back a long time, back into the 70s. Linda Bellingham, obviously though, a very brave woman, taking control of her life, making this decision for herself, and dying with dignity. I don't want to get too political here, but I think that's a really great thing. I think that's, you know, if it has to be, then to do it on your own terms is a great thing, and I salute her for that. But very, very sad to be reading this news story here just as I'm finishing the episode, and knowing that Linda Bellingham won't be with us much longer after Christmas, it seems. So sad news there to end on, but I guess it can't always be happy out there in the real world. All right, everyone, that was a great episode of Who Wars. Thank you for listening in, and until next week, until episode 5 of the show, 5 already, I'm Rob Irwin. Good night.
Well, that wraps it up for another episode of Who Wars. If you'd like to be in touch with the show, simply email hello@whowars.net. Find us on Twitter @WhoWars, or if Facebook's more your thing, at facebook.com/WhoWars. Oh, and don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. See you next time. Oh,